This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 67 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frühling, and with me, as always, is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be discussing examples of the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard's Stages on Life way from the Star Trek universe. Mike, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing well. It's been a long week. I'm a little tired, but I'm always glad to sit down and talk Star Trek and philosophy, and I think this is going to be a fun podcast.
Well, I am on vacation right now, so I'm not as tired as you are because you've been working all day and I've kind of been lounging around the house all day exploring some of the other stages of life's way than my usual MO.
Do a little Viva Las Vegas.
Well, I'm not in Vegas yet, but yes, I am going to Las Vegas on vacation.
You're going a few months early, aren't you?
I am. Sadly, I won't be able to make it to Star Trek Las Vegas this year, but I'd like to say I was scoping out the sites, but no such luck.
No such luck, nor for me. So we'll follow everybody's Twitter feeds and live vicariously through them, other friends from the network.
I'll try not to get stuck in the Royale while I'm there.
Don't want to get stuck at the Royale.
Well, last time on Metatrex, we were talking about the ethics of expanding knowledge and exploring. We were talking about different personality types, the type of personality that's attracted to going warp 13 with hair on fire, you know, this kind of reckless, willing to risk it all, adventurer personality. And that got me thinking about different personality types, which in turn got me thinking about Søren Kierkegaard's views of different ways you can approach life. What he called stages on life's way, which is actually not a very good name for the concept that he has in mind, because it's not like these are like linear stages where you progress from being one personality type to another personality type to another personality type. It's more like there are different ways or modes you can approach life in general, and most of us shift back and forth amongst these in various ways. I just thought it would be fun if we could talk about what those stages are and see if we can find good examples of characters in the Star Trek universe that typify these different approaches to life that Kierkegaard thinks he's discovered.
And Zachary, you and I were talking in the turbo lift before the program, and I was curious, it's one of these ask a writer someday questions, I was curious as to whether or not there is some kind of connection between Søren Kierkegaard and the character Søren from Star Trek Generations.
So you're saying that instead of saying Kierkegaard, we should say Kierkegaard, Dr. Søren Kierkegaard.
Absolutely, that's the way we should do it for the rest of the program.
I'm not sure they have much in common other than the name.
No,
honestly, I'm not much of a biographer. Honestly, you know, I tend to focus on a philosopher's actual philosophy and writings more than their biography. So I would be hard pressed to make a biographical comparison between Dr. Søren and Søren Kierkegaard.
Well, I find it fascinating because oftentimes writers will throw a little homage into a favorite writer or a favorite personality. Lemony Snicket does it probably better than any modern day author. He will weave his favorite authors into his stories. He'll slide in their names in one way or another into the stories. Like, you know, Poe, for instance, he's paid homage to. So just kind of curious as to whether or not somebody decided to give a nod to Søren Kierkegaard and give that name to Malcolm McDowell's character in Generations. Just one of those, I hope I can ask somebody that question one day kind of things.
Well, Dr. Tolian Søren is missing the little Danish crosshatch in the O in Søren, right? So Talk about a missed opportunity.
I think there are some connections there with Soren, the character from Generations. His quest, his lifelong quest to get back to the Nexus. And I find it interesting that that was the name choice. I don't think it was just a happy accident. I think there's something intentional there.
Well, not to belabor the joke, but Elorians are very long-lived. Perhaps Dr. Soren did visit 19th century Denmark.
Well, if Guinan can visit 19th century America, then certainly...
Yeah, maybe they were single-serving friends on the shuttlecraft that took them there.
That's certainly a possibility.
I'm thinking of this on the fly, but in a way, I think you might be onto something, because Dr. Soren in Generations is searching for something. He had something, he's lost it, he's had, I don't want to call it a crisis of faith, but he certainly had a crisis of some sort. What would you call it? What kind of crisis? I mean, he's lost everything. That's not a crisis of faith, but that could spawn a crisis of faith such that he's desperately seeking a way to try to return to a state of authenticity that he's lost. And when you put it in those terms, he sounds a lot like Soren Kierkegaard.
You know, I think there's probably no better way to put it than a crisis of faith. You know, I have experienced in my own life periods where I feel I've lost something in terms of, you know, internally in my spirit, in my soul.
Marbles.
In my marbles, yes. But I've had these moments, and I call them moments, but you know, in some cases, at least one case, it took me a couple of years to kind of work out. And I call it a crisis of faith because in those moments, we tend to question everything. You know, something isn't right. I feel that I've lost something, and I begin to question things. And I think when we meet Soren in Generations, he's at that point. You know, he's lost something. He's on a quest to reclaim it, and it's caused him. I would venture to say that if you were to go back and do a prequel, you would probably find out that Dr. Soren's not such a bad guy. But certainly when we meet him in Generations, his ethics are questionable, and he is willing to end lives in order to get what he wants. And I think that's a man in crisis. Call it a crisis of faith or crisis of ethics, I'm not sure, but he's definitely a man in crisis. And I do. I think there's a connection there to our fair Soren Kierkegaard.
Well, a little known fact is that one of Kierkegaard's lost manuscripts had to do with ceasing nuclear fusion inside of a star.
That's an interesting...
That's what you get here on Metatrex, alternate philosophy history. Alt philosophy. No, I think you're onto something because... I mean, I experience this as I get older. You've had a few more years on you than I've had, but we're not
Thanks
young
for reminding
anymore.
Me.
Neither one of us. No, neither one of us is 18. We can't start over like a rock cadet. But what I've experienced is that there are stages and phases and movements in life. You know, I go in and out of certain personality attributes or in and out of certain phases. Certain abilities come to the forefront and then phase back. And life is very fluid in this way. And I think what's interesting about Kierkegaard's notion that there are stages in life is that we move in and out of these very fluidly. My experience has been that they're not static. They're not rigid. Mm-hmm. I'm not strapped to a personality type or strapped to a station in life or strapped to, you know, one way of approaching faith or life or belief or knowledge or, you know, anything in life.
Right.
That the movement between these different phases and stages and moods, for lack of a better word, is very fluid and dynamic. Like, I'm different than I was. I mean, I'm different now than I was when we first started doing podcast.
Certainly.
I'm different than I was, you know, nine years ago when I had my last career. I'm different than when I was a philosophy teacher. I'm different from when I was a grad student. I'm different from when I was a Radio Shack salesperson, right? These are just different. Yeah, those are just careers, but there's different approaches to life that have come with different time periods and different events that have happened and my reaction to different things. You know, as I get a longer and longer history, I find that the way in which I relate to other people and to the world and to events, whether it's good things or bad things or a crisis or, you know, whatever the next unexpected thing is, those all seem to change. I mean, I'm a different person than I was a few years ago. And I think what's interesting about that to me is that sometimes I feel like I'm more in control of that than others. Sometimes I feel like I'm very reactive and I'm just kind of taking life as it comes. And other times I feel like I've managed to kind of grasp onto a little more control, and I'm in the driver's seat kind of choosing which approach to life. And sometimes it feels like the whole universe like is, you know, encroaching in like a fleet of Romulan warbirds. And I have to kind of, you know, get out of the crisis. But other times it's like, okay, you know, I'm in command and I'm exploring and I'm choosing how to approach life. And in reality is almost always somewhere in the middle for me. So I know we haven't talked much yet about what those stages are, and we're going to dive into that in a minute. But I think, you know, my sort of pre-philosophical reflection on this is that it's that our way of relating to each other and to the universe and to the world around us and to events is fluid and dynamic, and it changes over periods in your life, and you move in and out of these different approaches versus being sort of fixed and rigid, or almost rather than being predetermined by your personality type.
I agree wholeheartedly. You know, some of our listeners in the more temperate climates maybe won't be able to relate to this. You know, it's getting into this, you know, late spring and moving into the summer season. Temperatures here in North Texas are starting to climb. I went out
like a Borg cube.
I went out and flew a kite last Sunday, got some sun. It was pretty warm. So I'm originally from West Virginia, and we would occasionally get, pretty heavy blizzards. We would get snow rather frequently in the wintertime. And I've always likened the journey of life to a snowball. You know, it starts out rather small, and you roll it around, and as you roll it around, it collects the snow off of the ground, and it grows. And it changes shape sometimes. Sometimes it gets off balance. It's not such a ball. It's more like a more egg-shaped or oval-shaped. And then you get it in your hands, and you kind of mold and shape it, and you scrape a little snow off. You move a little. You pack a little. And I kind of think of life in those terms. I think that as we move through life, we, you know, we have periods where we grow and collect from the atmosphere around us. So you talked about, you know, life as a Radio Shack salesman. That's something that I can relate to. I've been there literally, out there selling TSPs, with every piece of electronic that I sold. And
that's your obscure reference for the
day.
Do you
want batteries with that? I've been there, man. I've completely been there. And so,
something for our listeners to Google. TSP.
What's TSP? Go Google Tandy it, Service Plan. Google it anyway. But, I moved from that, and, you know, I think about, my college days. I, early in my ministry, when I was first starting out in ministry, and I've worked in the newspaper industry, I've worked in the healthcare industry, and you experience things in life, and you grow, and sometimes you get a little lopsided, and sometimes you get compacted and smushed, and things get shaved away. You know, jobs come, jobs go, relationships come and go. I think about some of the relationships that I've had, and I think in the Star Trek universe, I think we see lots of examples of, you know, life unfolding, especially when we look at, since we're talking about generations, we talk about Star Trek: The Next Generation. You know, here's a show we got to see 7 years plus in the lives of, you know, our crew of the 1701D and E, for that matter. And we got the movie era, which extended that out a little bit for us. And we got to see them grow and change. And we saw relationships come and relationships go. And some of those relationships were glad they're gone, such as Worf and Deanna. We got to see, you know, personal growth. We got to see Data become closer to humanity than he probably would have ever thought possible when we first met him in season one. And we saw Riker grow up and mature. And it's just it's interesting. I mean, Geordi wasn't even chief engineer when we started, and we got to see him move into a new function on the ship, and we saw how that changed him. And we know that's fiction, but I think that's a beautiful snapshot of what really happens to us in life.
I'm glad you mentioned Data, because I think Data is in a unique position where, being an android and with this goal of trying to become as human as he possibly can be, he's the one who has to decide which form of human life he wants to emulate. He has to choose who are his role models, which ways of life are not productive, should he not emulate, what's ethical, what's not, what's enjoyable, what's not, what relationships are valuable and which relationships are poisonous for him. And he doesn't have anyone to answer those questions for him. He's got role models, but ultimately ultimately he has to decide what kind of human life do I want to live insofar as he's trying to decide to be as human as he possibly can. And we're all like that. We all have to decide who are our role models, what do we value, what are we going to choose, how are we going to choose to spend our time, what are we going to choose as virtues, what are we going to choose as vices, what do we make our lives? And that's basically the question Kierkegaard is asking. What are the different ways we can approach life, and which of those are more authentic? Which of these are valuable and productive, and which of these, even if we can't avoid falling into these modes sometimes, which of them are not as virtuous from the perspective of an overall human life?
You know, it's interesting that you kind of focused in on Data. I think about some of the silly experiments that he tried over the course of the 7 seasons to expand his understanding of humanity, to try and add something to his programming. For instance, when he decided to try dating, he tried a dating relationship. That was his grand little experiment. So he writes a program and he decides that he's going to expand his horizons. He's going to, you know, experiment with, you know, a romantic relationship. And he got lots of advice, some good and some not so good. Riker was right there with some great advice, of course. But I think about that in terms of Data consciously making the decision that he's going to write some programming and he's going to expand his horizons a little bit. And isn't that what we do when we engage in a relationship, be it a romantic relationship or a friendship? I'm thinking back to nearly 2 years now that you and I connected after one of our patrons roundtables and decided that, you know, we were going to form a partnership and do a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Neither of us had ever done it before. But, you know, we thought, what the heck, was let's give this a try. And here we are 2 years later, and it's fundamentally changed us. This grand little experiment of ours called Metatrex.
Well, I feel like after nearly 2 years, we should have more episodes than we have.
That's not quite been 2 years, but
it's been more like a year and a half. But it's hard to do this every week. Honestly, it can be remarkably difficult to do this every week and sound like we know what we're doing. So,
yeah, 67 episodes in a year and a half. That's not too shabby.
That's pretty good. That's nothing to sneeze at. But you're onto something with the fact that Data can program himself. I mean, every time he tries to emulate humanity, that's what he has to do. He has to kind of write a new subroutine, write a new modification to his default programming. And think what it would be like if we all approached life a little more like that. I feel like a lot of us, a lot of the time, are reacting. There's this stuff coming from outside, whether it's from work or relationships or whatever it is, and we're just reacting to the crisis. What's the next? What do I have to deal with tomorrow? What do I have to deal with next week? And it would be interesting to, this is kind of an interesting thought experiment. What if you took this sort of programming mindset that we see in Commander Data and that we honestly have in the world today, right? We can talk in terms of programming in computer languages. This is 21st century speak, right? This wasn't intelligible to Søren Kierkegaard in the 19th century. What if you gave those tools to someone like Søren Kierkegaard and said, okay, you have this ability to program your own life. What kind of program are you going to write? And it's interesting to kind of ask the fundamental question Kierkegaard is asking. What is the most productive, or not productive, but what's the most satisfying, authentic approach to life? What does that mean? It would be interesting to say, okay, here's the tools of programming. Suppose you can program a human, program your own life. What kind of program would you write? What would that mean? I think that's actually a really productive way to think about the question that Kierkegaard is asking. What's the most authentic human life?
I agree. You know, as I think about this, though, you're right. I think most of us as human creatures are very reactive. But let's face it. There are decisions that we make in life that we program to some degree. For instance, when my wife and I were engaged and we got married, we married June.
You wrote
June,
the marriage function?
Yeah. June 12th, 1994 was a day that fundamentally changed who I am. I made a conscious decision to enter into a lifelong relationship with my wife, who at the time I had only known for about 7 months or so. And did I have to change my habits? Did I have to change you know, what I do on a day-to-day basis. Yes, I made a conscious decision to do that. Now, don't get me wrong. Some things are reactive. You know, for instance, which side of the bed are you going to sleep on? Which sink are you going to use? And those kind of things. Or
well, if that's all you're reacting sometimes to, that's a bit pretty reactive. Good.
But, you know, and then again, you know, you make the conscious decision to, you know, to, for instance, buy a house had to, or have...
You probably had to modify the program from time to time.
Yeah, have a family. You have to modify the program. And then, don't get me wrong, again, some things are going to be reactive. There are things that you couldn't anticipate when you wrote the program, well, but you're still writing programs.
But that's interesting that you say that, because I feel like when we're reacting, what we're doing is not necessarily, we're not in planning stages. We're not writing a new program when we're reacting. We're experiencing the unpredictable consequences of the past programming that we wrote, the inadequacies of the past programming, right? If you say, I'm going to program the next 10 years of my life, here's my long-term plan, here's what I'm going to do over the next few months, whether it's school or relationships or work or whatever it is, right? And then a crisis comes up and you realize that your program was inadequate to handle the event at hand. And you have to figure out that crisis based on everything you have planned for, which is inadequate. But, and then hopefully after that, you learn something and then you can, you know, plan a little better for the next crisis. But my experience has been that when I'm in a crisis, I'm not in programming mode. I am experiencing that what I've programmed in my life has been inadequate to deal with the thing at hand.
Yeah, and that, again, Zachary, that is a great way to put it. I mean, I'm sitting here, I'm holding my, I'm a little bit behind. I've got a Samsung S6. It's a couple of years old. They just come out with the S8. I hope to get one of these days. But you know, my smartphone updated its programming last night. I woke up this morning and it was like a whole new phone. Why do they do that? Because the programming that it was inherently with it was inadequate. And so they updated.
Which stage of life did it choose?
Exactly. Hey, you should know. I mean, you invented an app and you've made modifications, changes to that app in anticipation and some reacting to needs that you found inherently that were inadequate, that needed to be, you know, refreshed and updated. And so I think you can probably come at this a bit more intelligently than I can.
As fruitful as I think this line of reasoning is, and I think it's an interesting one worth exploring. I think we can dwell on it a little more as we get further into the conversation. But I think we should probably back up just a little bit and talk about what Kierkegaard's stages of life's way actually are, the different ways that he thinks people approach life. Talk about their strengths and weaknesses, look at some examples in Star Trek, and then maybe circle back and talk about this in the context of programming one's life, you know, a la Commander Data. Because I think I don't want to forget about that line of reasoning, but I do want to circle back and talk about these stages, because I feel like we can find a ton of examples in the Star Trek universe of people who typify each one of these different phases. So real quickly, let's run down the list. So one stage of life's way, and again, by stages, I don't mean like progressive linear stage. It's not like this is a more immature stage. It's just one way of approaching life, is what Kierkegaard calls the aesthetic way or the aesthetic stage. And by aesthetic, he means like novelty, seeking adventure, seeking pleasure, seeking the next new experience, not grounded in any sort of principles, not grounded in any sort of conviction about anything, but just, you know, thinking of life as a series of new adventures or a series of new experiences to be had. So that's the aesthetic approach. And I feel like the names that Kierkegaard uses don't really capture what he actually means. And I think that's one of the frustrating things about talking about Kierkegaard is his actual words don't really help understand what he has in mind.
Yeah, perhaps for the sake of this being a Star Trek and philosophy podcast, maybe we should call that the William Riker stage.
Well, maybe. We'll talk about examples here in a minute, because I think what's interesting about each of these is that most of us are an amalgam of all of these, and we move in and out of them. And I think the characters we see in the Star Trek universe are probably going to be like that. There are certainly elements of Commander Riker that are focused on the next new experience, right? When he goes to Risa, he's looking for some novelty. But that's not all of Commander Riker. And all of us are generally like that. We move in and out of mm-hmm. these phases, and really we have all of them, you know, competing against each other a lot of the time. And so Kierkegaard doesn't think of these as rigid, fixed stages that like you're firmly in the aesthetic stage and there's no other complexity to your personality. That's not what he's saying. But that's one. That's the aesthetic stage. The next stage is the ethical stage. And by ethical, he means someone who's committed to duty, obligation, rules, doing things because things are expected, the right thing to do. You know, the personality type I'm talking about, the people who are motivated by duty and obligation and they're rigid, and that's their approach to life. That's why they do what they do.
And I tend to put myself in that category more than I can find elements of my own personality in each of these stages of life's way. But ethical is one that I can really relate to because I am, you know, very, very duty oriented. I tend to be one of those people that follow the rules. If you give me a handbook, I'm going to memorize it and I'm going to quote it. And yes, I'm one of those people.
I think where this really comes up is when other people violate what you perceive as a rule. Then you can get rigid and ethical and critical, and you invoke those rules as a standard for other people. I think that's where the rubber really meets the road with this view. You know, people who are like this, they're rule-based. They don't just apply to their own lives, but they view the entire world, their entire worldview, you know, their entire reality, everything they know, all the people they know are constrained or squeezed into a rigid, rule-based worldview.
Yeah. And as a manager, and I've spent most of my professional career in management of one type or another, that, you know, again, that's me.
Mm-hmm. That's you. Ethical Mike.
That's me. Ethical Mike.
There's probably more to you than that.
There's definitely more to me than that, but I can definitely relate to that.
The third phase or the third stage of life for Kierkegaard is what he calls the religious phase. And for people who are not religious out there, don't let the term bother you. By religious, he means the authentic stage, the stage which you've consciously chosen to commit your life to something, commitment to things, genuine faith, taking a leap of faith, dedicating your life to something that you're consciously choosing. You know, when you're invoking rules, when you say, I got to do this thing because it's my duty or it's my obligation, it's almost like it's inauthentic. Like you don't really want to do it. You're doing it because it's the rule, right? Mm-hmm. Here, Kierkegaard means you're choosing authentically to do whatever you do, to pursue something, to follow a cause, to believe in something, to dedicate your life to something in an authentic, freely chosen kind of way. That's what he means as the religious stage. But often those things are anti-rational. They're sort of illogical. And Kierkegaard, inside his work, uses the example of Abraham and Isaac. You know, Abraham gets this message from God to go sacrifice his son, mm-hmm. son Isaac. And the way the story is usually told is that Abraham goes, okay, God, if that's what you say to do, I'm going to hike up the mountain. I'm going to whip out a knife and sacrifice my son. And it glosses over the internal struggle that Abraham must have had about this, right? This is something it's irrational. It makes no sense, but he's chosen to follow God's commands. And so he, you know, anguishes inside and is going to follow through on what God has told him to do. But Kierkegaard wants to dwell on the anguish that when you're dedicating your life to something, there's a struggle to it. It's not easy. You freely choose to do it. It doesn't make any sense, but you've chosen to take a leap of faith. And it doesn't have to be in the context of Christian theology. It can be in the context of whatever Certainly. You're dedicating your life to do. If you choose to follow a new career or go get an educational degree or to explore the galaxy in the Star Trek universe, those are leaps of faith, right? You don't know what the outcome is going to be. It's safer to stay on Earth. It's safer to stay in your comfort zone. You're putting yourself out there and taking a leap of faith. And in a way, it's irrational because you don't know what the outcome is going to be, right? And you've chosen to indicate that it matters to you. You're taking that leap of faith because you've chosen, this is what I'm going to do. And it matters to me. And so I'm going to do it. I don't care what the consequences are. I don't know if it makes sense yet. I'm taking a leap of faith. And that's the kind of authenticity that Kierkegaard means by the religious phase. You know, when you've chosen to take a leap of faith, to dedicate your life to something that's freely chosen, not purely because it's bound by rules or not purely because it's a new aesthetic experience.
And again, I'm just going to have to label this the Chief O'Brien stage.
Wait, okay, are you keeping track of these? What was the aesthetic? So the aesthetic stage was the Commander Riker stage. The ethical stage was what? Did you have?
We did.
The Mike stage, but.
We didn't really label that one, but we should.
I would say Lieutenant Worf is like this a lot of the
yes,
time.
Yes, he is. He absolutely is.
That's the best example that comes to my mind is the Lieutenant Worf stage. We can talk about why in a minute, because Worf is very driven by duty and obligation and rules and principles.
Sure, sure. And we actually see a lot of examples of that in the Star Trek universe. But yes, I think Worf is an outstanding example of that. And of course, I chose Chief O'Brien for the religious stage because here's a guy who enlisted in it. We forget sometimes that he is an enlisted man. He's not an officer. He didn't go to the academy. He enlisted. He is in the service, and he can get out of that at any time he chooses. You know, he doesn't have to re-enlist each time his time comes up. And it's always Chief O'Brien kind of volunteering for those tough jobs. In fact, one of my favorite Chief O'Brien lines, you know, he's getting ready to crawl through a Jeffries tube. It's a very dangerous thing that he's taken upon himself to do. And he says, as he's crawling away, "If you see my wife, please don't tell her I did this." But he's,
well, the part of the reason I think this is difficult is that in a way, you're right. You're onto something. Everyone we see in the Star Trek universe can resign whenever they want. We see plenty of examples of officers resigning their commission and walking away with no obligation to stay, right? So they've all freely chosen to be there. And I think this is why it's hard to take characters in the Star Trek universe and pigeonhole them into one of these categories, because they are all in Starfleet because they want to be, with some notable exceptions that I think we can talk about in a minute. But generally, from captains on down, everyone is there because they want to be. So they've all dedicated their lives to Starfleet in a freely chosen, I don't want to say it's irrational, but they've certainly taken something, they've freely dedicated their lives to it in a way that's not purely duty-based or obligation-based or rule-based or doing it because they have to. So almost everyone in the Star Trek universe, I think, broadly falls into the religious category from Kierkegaard. Okay, so we have our labels, and we want to dive into each of these. So we've got the Commander Riker phase with the aesthetic approach. We've got the Lieutenant Worf phase with the ethical approach, and we've got the Chief O'Brien phase with the religious approach.
There we go. Yeah.
So let's dive into each of these a little more. Can we think of other characters in the Star Trek universe that typify each of these? So let's start with the aesthetic phase or the Commander Riker phase. Are there characters in the Star Trek universe, either from Starfleet, from an alien race, whatever, that they're motivated primarily by seeking out new experiences, whether those are adventures or pleasures or novelty, but they're primarily motivated by seeking out new experiences?
Julian Bashir, when we first meet Julian, he is coming to Deep Space Nine. First of all, he comes to Deep Space Nine. He's hitting on Jadzia Dax. She's an adventure. He sees everything as an adventure. In fact, he really sets Kira off because he refers to her home as the frontier, which belittles her to some degree. And it's kind of a funny, you know, throwaway line in the very first episode of Deep Space Nine, but everything to him, he's young, he's fresh out of the academy, he's wide-eyed, he's bushy-tailed, and he's ready to find an adventure and to make his mark. And I think Julian fits into this aesthetic phase quite well.
That's a really interesting pick, because Dr. Bashir is principled. He wants to do good work while he's on the frontier, but the whole reason he's out there on Deep Space Nine is for novelty. He has this vision of himself out on the frontier doing things no one else has done before. And you're right. I think it's motivated by the novelty of it all rather than he does have principles. He does want to do good work. He's a good doctor, but that's not his primary motivation from the beginning.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, the character that came to my mind is kind of an obscure character. It's from the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, The Most Toys.
Yes.
The alien who's collecting he's collecting the baseball cards, and he's collecting this artifact and that artifact, and he ends up collecting Commander Data. He's unprincipled. He's not dedicating his life to anything important. He just wants to collect the most toys. And I think that is, as I thought about this before we started recording, that was like the clearest example in my mind of someone who's just motivated by novelty. He just wants to collect as many toys as he can.
Yeah, Zachary, I think Fajo is a great pick. He is. He's completely motivated by novelty. Everything that he has is not even for his own pleasure, but so he has something to brag to his friends about. So I think that's an excellent pick.
And I guess none of it has any real meaning for him. The significance of it is not for historical significance. It's not for preservation. It's not for any principled reason whatsoever, either from an ethical rule-based standpoint standpoint, or from even a religious authenticity standpoint. He's not, it's not like he's such a sincere baseball fan that he's got to collect that baseball card, right? That's authentic. You're freely choosing to be interested in something. But he just wants to brag to his friends and collect the most toys. So that's the best example I could think of. But can we think of any others?
Well, I do want to say something else about Faggio. Because I think he represents something that can be a danger if our life is completely motivated by this aesthetic stage on life's way. Faggio is to a point in his own life where he doesn't value anything. I mean, he doesn't value data. He wants data, but it's for the novelty of it. He doesn't value that baseball card. It's for the novelty of it. And so he doesn't value anything. And even the people whom he has relationships with, he doesn't value them either. And he proves as much in the episode. So he's come to a point in life where he doesn't even value the lives of the people around him. And I think that's a sincere and real danger of someone who is driven solely by aesthetic, novelty, adventure. There's no ethical drive. There's no sincere commitment to them. They're just driven by novelty. And so that's all they value.
And Faggio is interesting. At the beginning of the episode, he is very animated, right? He's excited about the fact that his baseball card still smells like bubblegum, mm-hmm. right? And so in a way, he's an appealing character. And people who are motivated by this aesthetic approach to life, adventure seeking or pleasure seeking or experience seeking, can often be very animated. They do get enthused by the next adventure, right? It's the person who's always climbing the next mountain or going to a foreign country, and they're just always doing something new. That's the entire mode that they live in. But I think you're right. I think when you look at that more objectively, you go, yeah, they're kind of missing something. They don't seem to really value the things that are causing them to be enthusiastic. And Faggio, of course, he doesn't value anything. But I know people like this where they seek out the next adventure, but they struggle with genuine relationships and they struggle with dedicating their lives to something. Oftentimes they seem a little unstable, mm-hmm. and they just don't have, you're right, they just don't seem to value either the things that they're choosing to spend their time pursuing, or life itself, or other people for that matter.
So Zachary, my mind actually went to a season one episode of Voyager, Prime Factors, when the crew of Voyager happens upon this hedonistic race of people who are simply motivated and obsessed with pleasure. And they're there to give, and it's nice for Captain Janeway and for the crew of Voyager, because, you know, they're just getting started on this journey, but they are tired. They're a long way from home. And so the allure of it at first is very appealing, but, you know, quickly they begin to realize that these people are motivated again, simply by pleasure, and there's no room for unpleasantries of any kind, and that includes, you know, a sincere business negotiation.
I'm glad you thought to mention this episode. Also, FYI, we literally just recorded an episode of To the Journey with Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw, my co-host over there, about this very episode, Prime Factors and Voyager. I think this episode of Metatrex will come out before that episode of To the Journey. But you're right, the aliens in that episode, the Sakaarans, they are motivated primarily by pleasure, but pleasure not in some sort of deep, long-term, authentic sense, immediate, in-the-moment pleasures that preclude them from forming real, deep, authentic relationships with the Voyager crew, right? They're always on to the next pleasure, you know, and you know people like this, they're motivated by such short-term pleasures that they don't take long-term pleasures and happiness into account, and they focus on novelty to the detriment of the relationships with the people that should matter to them.
Yeah, and you know, of course, they have the ability to literally transport themselves anywhere in the galaxy at will. And Captain Janeway, she wants to negotiate for that technology because obviously that would get them home immediately. So there's instant gratification. But this race of aliens, they have a similar policy that Starfleet has. They don't share technology, and it becomes a sticking point for them and their relationship. And Laban actually offers to allow the crew of Voyager to stay. He wants them to stay. And don't you like it here? Don't you? We have all of these pleasures, all of these things. It's all for you.
He's like, would you like some pleasure?
Would you like some pleasure? But but Janeway kind of calls him on it because she questions how long is this going to be a relationship that they value. When are you going to grow tired of us? You know, we're just the latest fad. She calls him on it, and she's absolutely right. Again, when somebody is so one-sided with this aesthetic stage and there's no genuine faith, there's no obligation, there's no sense of duty, it's very one-sided and hedonistic.
It's funny that I'm talking about this subject right now while I'm on vacation, because I honestly feel like studying Kierkegaard has ruined vacations for me forever, because I can't shake this disturbing feeling that every time I go on vacation, you know, you go to a new town, a new adventure, someplace you haven't been, that you kind of start slipping into the aesthetic category, that you're worrying more about novelty and adventure seeking and doing something you haven't done before than things that really substantively matter. I don't know if other people experience this, but I actually get this like deep existential worry about vacations now. And they, I don't want to say they've ruined vacations for me, but there is a part of me that lurks down underneath this, you know, dissatisfied philosopher looking at vacations going, yeah, but none of that really matters. That's just pleasure seeking. That's like collecting toys, or that's like pleasure with the Sakaarans. You know, that doesn't really matter. So I'm going to Las Vegas. I mean, talk about new experiences, right? If you're going to go to one city that's a pleasure seeking city, it's Sin City, right? So, you know, in going to vacations, are we slipping into the aesthetic category?
Well, I'm going to answer that by saying that I think that an authentic life is a life that is balanced. And that balance does require some pleasure seeking from time to time. And we think about, at least here in the United States, I know it's not this way in Europe. I know it's not this way south of our border in Mexico. There are other places around the world where it's not the, you know, it's not this way. But here in the United States, you know, it's a grind. I mean, you know, if you live in a metropolitan city, you've got usually long commutes if you don't, you know, if you don't work from home or work remotely, something like that. But, you know, millions of people have these long commutes and they work long hours, and sometimes it's 6, sometimes 7 days a week. I've been there where you're working 70, 80 hour weeks and you're commuting an hour each way, and there's no room for novelty, for adventure, for pleasure. And so you get 1 week or maybe two out of the entire year where you have a chance, Zachary, just a chance to go and capture a little pleasure. And I know that there are people listening to this podcast going, really, a week? You get a whole week? And believe me, I get it. And I know people in other parts of the world where the grind is worse than it is here in the United States. I know I've got a friend in Europe. He gets all kinds of time off. So, you know, that balance is a little, you know, that work-life balance we talk about here in the United States, the work-life balance is a little one-sided towards work. So I say to you, Zachary, go have a great time, man. put the money in the slot machine, pull the lever and have a blast.
There's definitely a mental health component that, you know, that grind can take a toll.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think it's a well-known fact that humans need balance. We need to blow off steam. We need to let our minds rest. And so there's definitely a psychology and a biology to all of those things. And it's a luxury. You know, not everyone has the luxury to even to take a vacation. So there's an element of this being a first world problem. But even people who...
Even data needs to paint.
Even data needs to paint. He's got to let that positronic brain rest. But I think partly we choose this grind. We choose the grind from an aesthetic standpoint. I know people that they work their, you know, proverbial tails off. And what they do is they buy flat screen TVs and the latest video game system. And then they travel a little bit. And then they, you know, they're working so they can acquire these new things. They're like collecting toys. And I do this a little bit. I like gadgets. I've got an iPhone. I've got, you know, my stand-up desk with my dual monitors. And I play some video games. I dabble in all these things. But I don't feel like I'm working for those things. Yes. And I do know people where I feel like that's why they're working, so they can collect toys. ways. And it undermines the integrity and the value and the meaningfulness of the work we do when you're working purely to collect toys. I don't know if you know people like that, but I feel like I know some people like that. And sometimes I fall into that category myself a little bit. I catch myself doing it. Like, you know, if I'm going to blow $2,000 on a new flat screen TV, I have to look at it and go, why am I doing this? Is this meaningful? Is it significant? You know, why am I dedicating my life to working what I'm doing to buy this thing that I'm buying? You know, if you're doing those things purely unreflectively, I feel like you're doing them out of something like Kierkegaard's notion of an aesthetic existence. So in terms of the aesthetic approach in Star Trek, so we've got Commander Riker, who definitely seeks novelty on Risa. We've got Fajo from the most toys in Star Trek The Next Generation. And then we've got Gath, Mr. Pleasure Laban in that episode of Voyager Prime Factors. Are there others that tend more towards the aesthetic approach to life? There aren't too many because people are very principled and dedicated in Star Trek, so it's hard to find examples of these, I think, good, clear examples.
Sure, yeah. Sure. But, you know, I see little bits and pieces. Malcolm Reed, for instance, is very duty-oriented, very, you know, very rule-driven, obligated. But he also has that aesthetic side to him. I always get a kick out of when Captain Archer tells him to fire on the enemy ship that happens to be firing on them. He always says, with pleasure.
Well, there's something to that, right? I mean, you know, it's exciting to blow stuff up. If you're the guy with your finger on the button, if it's your job to fire the phasers or the photon torpedoes, it's exciting when you get a chance to actually fire on another ship. So I can kind of picture Worf, as rule-based and duty-driven as he is, getting a secret pleasure out of, oh, good, I get to blow something new up this week every time he gets to fire phasers.
I see it more for Malcolm. Malcolm gets this kind of crooked smile. He gets this look on his face. I mean, he's so by the book and, you know, spit and polish Malcolm. But when Captain Archer says he can fire on that ship, he gets this little boy smile when he hits the button.
Well, I think there are people that do a good job of faking other people out. Like, there are people that pretend to be rule-based, or they pretend to be driven by duty, or they pretend to be dedicated to something. But when it comes down to it, they are really... Their more inner nature is more aesthetically driven, and vice versa. I think there are people that you know, they're always doing something new. They're going on vacations. They're buying new toys, but really they're principled inside and they're dedicated to something, but they don't share it very openly. So it's not like, you know, it's not like people's activities necessarily indicate what's going on inside them. And this might be a good case where, you know, yes, Malcolm Reed is, you know, he's very quiet, reserved, he's duty driven, but, you know, when he gets to push that button, he slips into aesthetic mode.
With pleasure.
With pleasure. Okay, so that covers the aesthetic approach pretty well. I think it's interesting that we found Commander Riker and we found two aliens in Star Trek that tend to typify this, because I think it's true. In Star Trek, you tend to not get a lot of characters like this because the writers go out of their way to make the humans, at least in Star Trek, very principled and very dedicated, you know, our ideal version of what humans should be. And we don't see a lot of this in, at least amongst the Federation species in Star Trek. I mean, you could see Klingons being like this. Klingons are aesthetic,
Klingons are very aesthetic.
You know, Klingons are always about drinking the blood wine and, you know, celebrating and being loud, and they're going to go, you know, blow something new up and glory and honor. But a lot of it's just because to capture the next victory.
I think Jadzia Dax is a lot this way. And again, don't get me wrong. I see.
Well, she's got so many lifetimes. She's bored. She's got to find novelty somewhere.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I definitely see, you know, duty and, you know, this ethical stage at work in her. She's very sincere. She's very genuine. But let's face it, she's a bit novelty driven. She's, you know, she's willing to go on that adventure. She's willing to go find the Sword of Kayla. She's willing to go and join three crazy Klingons as they go and find the albino and cut his heart out and eat it. She's going to do it. She's going to do it out of duty and obligation, but it's the adventure as well. And she's going to be the one that's having the party in her quarters and, you know, shaking her butt with Nog and...
But she's also found the balance, right? She's not living her entire life this way. These are balanced with her obligations and her duties to Starfleet and her career and her friends and relationships. But she's not living a life that's out of balance. And I feel like we all have this aesthetic approach sometimes to various degrees, but you're onto something with balance. I feel like if you slip too much into this mode to the detriment of rules and principles and duty, and to the detriment of dedicating your life to something that you're freely choosing to do because it adds meaning, then you're missing something in life. But we do need to psychologically relieve stress, and it's good to have a good time. Mm-hmm. No one's criticizing those things. And what's interesting to me is the ethical people, the people who are rule-based, look at that and go, oh my God, you can't do that. You're violating the rules. You're being too flippant. You're not being serious enough. You're not being whatever. So the people that have that ethical approach are very critical of the aesthetical approach, even more than I've been.
So, Zachary, what about the ethical approach?
Well, we're calling this the Lieutenant Worf approach.
Sir, I protest. I am not a merry man.
And there is, I would say, Worf, insofar as he has this idealized vision of what it means to be a Klingon, is very driven by rules and obligations. So Worf is the obvious example.
It's going to follow it to the letter.
I think another example that comes to my mind are the Badmirals in Star Trek, because they are always citing rules and citing principles. They don't really understand the situation. They're kind of doing it for some bureaucratic reason. And they are rule citers. They're not out there making authentic decisions in the moment. So that's something that came to my mind. The Badmirals in Star Trek tend to live this sort of duty, obligation, follow the rules, bureaucracy kind of approach to life. But are there others? Can you think of characters that are driven primarily by rules? I mean, you would think that Vulcan logic would come into play here. Vulcans tend to live an ethical approach. You know, they're not seeking novelty. They're not out there dedicating. They almost don't have the sense of authenticity, right? Because they're so logical about what they're doing that their decision making is driven primarily by logical rules and principles versus this inner drive to dedicate themselves to something that matters versus this. They don't need the novelty, of course, because they're Vulcans. But so Vulcans are a good candidate for characters in Star Trek that rely on the ethical approach to life.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Vulcans, because actually when you first asked the question, can you think of somebody, the first character on my mind is Tuvok. And he really is the primary example of what a genuine Vulcan is. I mean, you have to exclude Spock, because Spock is part human. So occasionally we see that human side kind of come up in him, not so much driven by aesthetics, but I think there's this sincere commitment, this genuine faith, this, you know, and he's the one that's willing to be a little irrational occasionally. And
Spock is the one who defied his father's wishes and joined Starfleet kind of against his father's wishes. So he's chosen to be in Starfleet in a very authentic way that is not typical for a Vulcan.
Sure, sure. But Tuvok is very rule-based. In fact, 9 times out of 10, if somebody's quoting regulation in Voyager, it's Tuvok. And he'll tell you exactly where to go find that regulation.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Tuvok, because this adds to the power of that episode, Prime Factors in Voyager, that we mentioned. The very episode where we get these aesthetic, pleasure-seeking aliens is the episode where Tuvok chooses to break the rules.
Yes.
For the sake of something that matters to Captain Janeway and to the rest of the crew, and maybe to himself. And you'd think that Tuvok would be, you know, so Vulcan that he's a pure rule follower, but lurking beneath the surface in Tuvok is a more complex personality than that. So I think the juxtaposition of these pleasure-seeking, aesthetic-seeking aliens and Tuvok, who you would think would be ethically based and rule-based, but in that very episode chooses to break the rules for things that matter to his crewmates and to himself. That's an interesting juxtaposition in that episode. It almost that episode right there is a little microcosm of these two personality types.
Oh, absolutely. But it's interesting to me, because his whole rationale is based on what Captain Janeway refers to as flawed logic. It's this sense of obligation to his captain, to his friend, Catherine Janeway, I think, that drives him to throw the rule book out the door in this particular episode. And so I think that still can fall under this ethical stage of life's way.
But he's also taking an irrational And he's justifying it in Vulcan logic, as Vulcans always do, right? But he's choosing to break the rules for the sake of something that he's decided to do that matters, right? He's choosing to help Captain Janeway out of her moral dilemma. He's choosing to help his crewmates get home. Mm-hmm. There might be some selfish motivation to get home lurking there behind the scenes too. And it is more like religious dedication, you know, choosing to do something freely than he's not doing it. Even though he's saying he's doing it out of Vulcan logic, I don't think that's really what's driving that. I think he's choosing to prioritize Captain Janeway's situation and feelings and his crewmates' feelings. And he's sort of twisting that around in Vulcan logic speak, saying, oh, it was the logical thing to do because of blah, 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 blah. But really, there's this emotional, religious, free choice authenticity to what he's choosing to do once you probe beneath the surface even a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. But more so than Spock, I think Tuvok is ethical.
The contrast between Spock and Tuvok is interesting because Spock, like we said, being half human but raised as a Vulcan, he enlisted in Starfleet against his father's wishes, whereas Tuvok, if memory serves, Tuvok's father was pleased that he was enrolling in Starfleet. He was encouraged to do it, and Tuvok needed some maturity. We got a glimpse into what young mm-hmm. Tuvok was like in another episode of Voyager, and he was emotionally chaotic and tumultuous and passionate, and he needed that structure to kind of guide him into being a more authentic Vulcan. So the contrast between Spock and Tuvok is rich on many levels because Tuvok, he needed that structure, that ethical rule-based approach to life to ground him emotionally. But after that, he's in Starfleet because he's choosing to be. He could do something else if he wanted to. He's not bound by rules or bound by a sort of time commitment. He could resign his commission and do something else. So once he's there, he's choosing to do it. But I don't think he was necessarily, it struck me that it wasn't authentic for him from the very beginning.
So who else do you think falls under this ethical stage of life's way primarily? Because for me, I think that there is a lot of this in the Star Trek universe, but it's peppered here and there in these characters because they're all duty bound. They all have a sense of obligation. They all have an obligation to follow the rules and to conduct themselves in an ethical and moral ways as they fulfill their commitment to Starfleet and to the United Federation of Planets. So
I think the distinction, though, Mike, is that Kierkegaard has in mind a kind of inauthentic ethical approach where you're being driven solely by rules and duty and obligation, in contrast to choosing to do something freely or mm-hmm. some authentic dedication to those principles that you're invoking in those rules. In fact, I just thought of a character that might where this might apply. I'm thinking of Wesley Crusher. Wesley Crusher, to some extent, is going into Starfleet and Starfleet Academy because it's expected of him,
mm-hmm.
right? It's something his father did. He's surrounded by Starfleet officers, so he is pursuing that career path. And that at a certain point, it clicks that it's not really for him, right? And when that light goes on, largely because of his experiences with the Traveler and his, experiences at the Academy, it starts to clue in that this is not really for him. This is not an authentic career path for him. His life should be dedicated to something else. And we see that come to a head in the TNG episode Journey's End, where as a result of the Traveler's guidance and mentoring, he realizes that his path is with the Traveler, exploring other facets of his humanity and growth and special gifts, and that being in Starfleet would be an inauthentic thing for him to do. So Wesley Crusher, I think, is a great example. He's living an inauthentic life out of duty and obligation or other people's expectations, and that at a certain point, the light bulb goes on, and he realizes, this is not for me. I needed to pursue a different path. And that's a difficult realization to come. I mean, everyone has had to, change directions in their life or change career or change relationships, whatever it is, has had this realization that they're on a path that is not authentic for them. And it's very difficult to change directions, do something different, reimagine your life. But that's something Wesley Crusher has to do. And it's that moment when he decides Starfleet is not really for me anymore that he becomes an authentic individual.
I'm glad you thought to mention Wesley Crusher, because I have to say that this is the toughest one of all, because you're right. Kierkegaard's distinction there, that it's ethical in an inauthentic way, I think is an important distinction. And I think you're exactly right. Wesley is that character, I think, that is inauthentic in that he is trying to follow in his father's footsteps. He seems to be motivated and driven solely to make Captain Picard proud, his mother proud. He's trying to be that upright, that perfect Starfleet officer for all the wrong reasons. In fact, Zachary, we talked a good deal about Wesley and his journey in episode 35 of Metatrex, entitled Wesley's Inferno. In fact, we were at that time talking about another interesting literary connection with Dante and in Dante's Inferno. So here we are talking Kierkegaard, and Wesley pops up again as a prime example.
I'm glad we're talking about Wesley again, because I do feel like Wesley, people don't understand the significance of Wesley's character. You know, he has a significant journey to take that, I mean, yes, a lot of people find Wesley annoying. He's used too many times in Star Trek The Next Generation to solve the problem at hand. Wesley saves the day again. It's a meme right at this point. But his journey is a journey that a lot of us should be able to relate to. There's expectations and rules, and that's the world that he lives in. At a certain point, he's got to decide, is this for me or is this not for me? What do I really want to do? And everyone has to have that realization at some point. We all have to choose, what do I do? Sometimes you have to go against your family's wishes, or sometimes you have to go against your mentor's wishes. Sometimes you realize the environment you're from is not where you should be, and you have to make a radical change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a great many people have experienced that about something in their lives. Sometimes it's grandiose, sometimes it's on a smaller scale. But I think that journey of Wesley is one that all of us can relate to. But his journey is different from everyone else's that we see in Star Trek The Next Generation in particular. Everyone else in Star Trek The Next Generation Starfleet's not a problem for them. They're officers and crewmen on the Enterprise because they want to be. They could do something else in the Star Trek universe. They're not bound to be there. They're freely choosing it. They've dedicated their whole lives to it. They find great amounts of meaning for them. It's a natural fit for most of them to various degrees. Maybe sometimes Worf it's not a natural fit for, but most of the time for most of them it's a natural fit, and they are choosing to pursue it, and it adds meaning to their life. And it just so happens that for Wesley it doesn't work that way. You know, it's not a good fit for him and his gifts and his personality and temperament and, you know, what he should be doing in life. It's not authentic for him. But I think for most of the characters we see in the Star Trek universe, especially members of the Federation and Starfleet, they are there authentically.
And we get to see a similar journey, although not as well fleshed out for Jake in Deep Space Nine. But Jake makes
and Captain Sisko for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. But for Jake, he was able to come to that conclusion much, much earlier. He didn't enlist in Starfleet. He decided before he took that leap and went to the academy that, you know what, his dad's path is not his. And so, dad, I'm going to be a writer. And he kind of takes his first steps into his own path. And you mentioned Captain Sisko. I mean, when we first meet Captain Sisko, he is this duty-bound Starfleet officer taking a post he doesn't really want and not sure how long he's going to be there. He's miserable, and he knows that he's kind of on a wrong path. But then, you know, it's kind of a happy accident, really, in some ways. And some people might feel that it's some type of providence or divine intervention, whatever it may be, that he happens to, find his destiny there on that starbase.
Commander/Captain Sisko is interesting because when we first see him in Emissary, I don't think he's duty-based at that point. He's ready to walk away from the entire thing. He's going to take this command right now because that's where they're sending him, but he wants Captain Picard to find a replacement for him, and he's on his way out of Starfleet at that point. But, you know, he's duty bound enough to where for the time being, in the moment, they're going to send him where they send him. He's going to do what he has to do because he's still an adult and he still has obligations, and he's going to do that, but he's doing it begrudgingly. Right? And at a certain point, he decides to embrace his role as commander of Deep Space Nine and as the emissary. And it takes a while for him, you know, a season or two or three before it really clicks, and he becomes the emissary. And that's who he is, and he chooses to identify as that, and that's a journey for him. But I think when we first see Commander Sisko, he is not at all authentic. I mean, he's acting out of duty, but barely that. I think he's begrudgingly acting out of duty. He's he knows he's in a crisis. He's going to do something else. He doesn't know what it is yet. He's lost. And, he's kind of like Abraham in Kierkegaard's Abraham and Isaac story, right? Mm-hmm. You could read Captain Sisko as saying, oh, fine, this is where Starfleet's sending me. So I'm going to go.
I'll drag myself
up the mountain over to Deep Space Nine. Yes. And that, because I was told to, you can kind of read Abraham that way in Kierkegaard's telling of the Abraham Isaac story. Abraham's like, okay, I don't really want to sacrifice my son, but God told me to, so I'm going to go up the mountain, even though I don't really want to. And it's too easy. And it ignores the struggle. I mean, Captain Sisko feels lost. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know where he belongs. He's lost his wife. He's lost his ship that he was on. He feels out of place. And he's going where he's told to go because he's duty bound enough to do that, but it's not authentic at all. And at a certain point he embraces the situation and he chooses to be the emissary and chooses to stay on Deep Space Nine when he could do other things after a certain point. And just like, you know, Abraham in the telling of the Abraham Isaac story, according to Kierkegaard, has to freely choose, you know, God's command here matters enough to me to where I'm willing to do this thing that God has told me to do that doesn't make sense. And I'm going to embrace it because that's what I choose to value and what I choose to prioritize. So at a certain point, Sisko, I think, becomes the more authentic version of this Abraham character.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's interesting because you and I were talking earlier in the podcast about crisis of faith. And I think when we first meet Captain Sisko, he certainly qualifies as a man in the midst of a crisis of faith. You know, everything
faith in his worldview, faith in Starfleet. We're not talking about religious faith in some narrow, Christian worldview sense. We're talking about faith in the things that matter to him.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Everything that he has held to in his life, you know, everything that he values. I mean, his wife is taken from him tragically. He's a single father raising his son. He's been given a post that he doesn't feel is ideal. And, you know, this is my thanks from Starfleet for the sacrifices. He's a man in crisis. And much like Abraham in the story of Abraham from Genesis and in Kierkegaard's telling of it, we don't really see a lot of that internal struggle. We don't know exactly what he was thinking or feeling. We can only assume. We can only guess.
I think if you draw the analogy out a little further, there's the version of Abraham, this retelling of the story. You can tell it different ways. Like, okay, God, I'm going to sacrifice my son, and it's no problem because you told me to. That's one way of telling that story, and Kierkegaard thinks that's a mistake. Then there's the, oh my God, this is terrible, but I'm going to do it anyway because, you know, my relationship with God matters enough to me that I'm going to do this irrational thing, and I'm dedicating myself to it. That reminds me a lot of the temperament we see in Sisko, mm-hmm. when he's willing to take a fleet of starships and go in the war with Dominion. And he says, fortune favors the bold. I can picture Abraham saying that. Fortune favors the bold. So I'm going to sacrifice my son, Isaac, right? I feel like the contrast between the inauthentic version of Sisko, who begrudgingly takes command of Deep Space Nine and he hates it. And he's looking for his way out of Starfleet. And he orders a replacement from Captain Picard. Versus the captain who sits in the captain's chair on the Defiant saying, fortune favors the bold, let's go end this war. You know, that's an amazing contrast. And that is a much more authentic version of Captain Sisko. He is firmly chosen to be where he is at that point.
Mm.
So I think we've kind of naturally segued into talking about Kierkegaard's view of the religious approach, where by the religious approach, again, for people who are confused by the terminology, because I think Kierkegaard's terminology helps obscure his real meaning here. By religious, he doesn't mean, you know, in a narrow Christian theology standpoint, although he was a Christian philosopher, and that is in fact what he means.
Yes.
But more broadly, he means sincere commitment, genuine faith in something, dedicating your life to something that matters, freely choosing to follow a principle or follow certain actions, taking an irrational leap of faith, you know, to dedicate your life to something. In some broader sense, that's what Kierkegaard means. And I do think that in general, most Starfleet characters fall into this category broadly, right? whenever you see a character in crisis, Worf has a crisis of faith about being in Starfleet. He's willing to resign his commission. Whenever you see someone willing to resign their commission, you kind of worry, are they having a crisis of faith about their who they are and their role in their career path in Starfleet? And, you know, you see this a few times in Star Trek. I mean, Captain Kirk is having a crisis of authenticity in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, mm-hmm. right? He's not being authentic. He knows he belongs on the bridge of a starship, sure. but he doesn't have the Enterprise anymore. He's feeling old. And I think we all feel that way sometimes. I do. I feel old sometimes. And I feel like, you know, I'm not doing what I want to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, but sometimes it's there lurking. And you go, well, God, get your command back. Get back in that chair. You know, do something. And McCoy is the voice of reason saying, well, get your command back before you really do get old. Don't let yourself decay and slip into doing something purely because you have to. And yes, you're an admiral and that means you should have a desk job, but don't let that obscure what would be more authentic and a better destiny for yourself. And I feel like most characters in Starfleet are authentic about their roles. But can we ask this question about other characters in Star Trek? The characters that are not in Starfleet, whether they're alien races or guest appearance kind of characters, which characters are sincere about who they are and what they're choosing to do? They're not doing what they're doing out of rules or obligation. They're not doing what they're doing out of some sense of novelty or seeking pleasure or seeking new experiences. Who are the most authentic characters in Star Trek based on who they are, their personalities, what they're choosing to do? Who is the most natural fit for who they are and what they're doing?
Before I answer that question, the theologian in me feels an obligation to say to our listeners, if you're interested in reading on Christian ethics, I don't think there is any better source than to grab some Kierkegaard, do some reading. Some of his texts, some of his works, as it relates to Christian ethics, is some of the best out there. He really deals with the authentic nature of the institution. Well, he juxtapositions the authentic nature of the church and the institution of the church. And I think there's some fantastic stuff out there to be had. If you go to the library or purchase online, get some Kierkegaard and do some reading if that interests you. So that being said, Zachary, to answer your question, I think, at least in my opinion, there is no more authentic character in Star Trek than Jean-Luc Picard. I really feel that he is genuine, he is sincere, he is dedicated. And yeah, as it pertains to duty, I see an Abraham nature in him. I see him grit his teeth and do what he's bound to do. But on the same hand, he's willing to take an irrational leap of faith. Even sometimes, you know, to say to hell with the orders, we're going to do what I know I have to do in order to be my most authentic self.
I think it's not always easy to distinguish between the ethical approach and the religious approach, or in more colloquial terms, the rule-based approach versus the authentic approach.
Yes.
Because the outward behavior can be the same.
Exactly.
Right? There can be a captain. You can imagine a captain in Starfleet that follows all the rules. They're driven by duty, driven by obligation, but it's not in any authentic sense. They don't really mean it. They don't really believe it. They don't find meaning out of it. They're just going through the motions, right? You can imagine that. It's not likely. We don't see it a lot on screen, but you can imagine that they would do a lot of the same things that Captain Picard does, because Captain Picard does believe in the rules and he does follow duty and he has obligations. The difference is that Captain Picard has internalized those. He has made those part of who he is. Mm-hmm. He's chosen to dedicate his life to them. He really believes that those principles and rules matter, and that's what he's chosen to do with his life. And so it's authentic for him, and he's thought about it. He's freely chosen to do those things. He's not doing them purely out of duty or purely out of obligation, but that is the most authentic version of Captain Picard, is to be captain of the Enterprise, pursuing the Federation's goals with its constraints and with its rules and with its command structure. Mm-hmm. But that's who he is and what he's chosen to do with his life.
And again, I think the thing that distinguishes Captain Picard as somebody who falls under the religious stage on life's way is that in order to be his most authentic self, he is willing to throw those rules out the door. He is willing to disobey orders in order to be true to himself and true to what he believes the mission of Starfleet is. And for that reason, I don't think we can say that he's entirely ethical. I think you're right. He's internalized it. That's a part of who he is. But I love the Captain Picard of First Contact at the beginning when he's been told, you know, the Borg have launched an objective against Earth and we want you to patrol the neutral zone. I love the sarcastic Captain Picard who gets that report from Commander Riker and he kind of tosses it on the desk and, you know, oh, you know, interesting, you know, so many parts per million. Oh, that's fascinating. That's so worthy of the resources that we have here on this ship. And I like that because he knows that that's not who he is. He believes that there is no better way to get the upper hand against the Borg than for him to be in the thick of it. And once he makes that decision, and to hell with the orders, Data's famous line, once he's made that decision, you know, he has gone from ethical Picard to this religious Picard who is sincerely committed to upholding the fundamentals, objectives, and principles of the Federation, and to the point that he's willing to forgo his orders and go do what he knows in his heart is right.
There's a scene that comes to my mind involving Captain Picard and Data that typifies what you're saying. It's a scene from Time's Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, there's a very brief conversation between Data and Captain Picard where Commander Data tells Captain Picard, "Captain, there can be no rational justification for this course." And Captain Picard just tells him, "Then I'll be irrational." I mean, at that moment, he's kind of being what Kierkegaard indicates, right? Yes, there's a rational course of action that the rules say you should do. But given the values that he's chosen to accept and given his role as captain, being in charge of the situation at hand, he sometimes has to be irrational, to go against what is rational or, again, in Kierkegaard's language, ethical, rule-based or duty-based or, you know, the normal constraints of the rules and principles that define what a captain can do. So Captain Picard is very willing in certain situations to say, "I'm going to be irrational. I'm the captain. Here's what we need to do because this is what's important."
Truly. And again, I know that seems like low hanging fruit. And I know we call this the Chief O'Brien stage of life's way. And I'm sticking with that because again, unlike most of the characters who went to the academy, who are officers, Chief O'Brien enlisted. He is an enlisted man that distinguishes him to some degree as someone who, they're all there by choice, but probably more than any other character, Chief O'Brien, he enlists. And I assume that, you know, in the 21st century, it's the same as it is today. Every 4 years, he probably has to re-enlist. And Chief O'Brien's always the one that volunteers for the hard jobs, even though he knows it's going to get him in trouble with his wife. And I think he typifies this idea of this religious stage of life's way. But I don't think there is a better example of this than Captain Picard.
You might actually question. So, yes, let's talk about Chief O'Brien for a minute, because this is interesting. You might say he's one of the most authentic characters we see as a Starfleet officer.
I think so.
You might say, in parentheses, that given he's always escaping from his home life by hanging out with Julian Bashir and seeking the hard duty, that he's not the most authentic husband there is out there.
But in his defense, Keiko has gone an awful lot.
That's true. Well, I hope I'm not reaching for an analogy, but we started this conversation here in this episode of Metatrex by talking about Commander Data, and I thought we might bookend the conversation by talking about Commander Data again.
Good idea.
Because it occurred to me that the end of Data's journey in Star Trek Nemesis is very much like what we see in the Abraham character, right? Data has a choice now. He's got the personal transporter. He can either pin it on himself and beam back. And probably the rule book says that's what he should do.
Right? Yes.
Right? He should get out of the dangerous situation, save as many lives as possible, you know, just get out of there. Right. You know, it's a no-win scenario at that point, but he has a choice. He can pin that personal transporter on Captain Picard and get Captain Picard back to safety and kill himself in the process, or he can beam himself back and Captain Picard will die in the process. He can't you know, beam both of them back. And he has to make this choice, the hard choice. Who do I save? What matters to me? And I think the fact that Data, who is, you know, driven by a positronic brain, it's, you know, he at least emulates free will, but he's a Starfleet officer. He's going to follow the rules generally. He's been on a journey. He's explored his humanity. He's got to choose what matters to him. And his final choice is one of value. You know, I value my friendship and I value my ability to save my crewmates' lives. He can, you know, if he beams back, I guess, you know, I'm trying to replay Star Trek Nemesis in my mind. If he beams back and he doesn't blow up the Scimitar, then all of his shipmates will die, right? Mm-hmm. Because the weapon's going to blow up. And he has to decide now, you know, whose lives matter and what can I do about the situation. He chooses freely as an android can to sacrifice himself, beams Picard back to the Enterprise, shoots the weapon and blows it up and prevents the weapon from going off, saving everyone's life. And that final choice, choosing to sacrifice not his son like in the Abraham Isaac story, but choosing to sacrifice himself.
Thank you because, for making you know, that distinction.
Yeah,
because I think that's an excellent connection.
That's not the rational thing to do. No. And that moment of irrationality is where Data is. I think this is why we say that's the moment where he's most human, right? Because that's the moment where he's authentically decided everyone else's lives matter to me more than my own. And I'm going to decide to do something about it, even to the end of his own life. And that's an irrational thing to do.
And you make the distinction that he's saving his crewmates, but I kind of bring that down into more of a micro choice for him. I think for Data, it came down to not just the entire crew of the Enterprise, but
Picard's his friend at that point.
Picard is his friend and his captain Mm-hmm. And I think what it came down to, it was, do I value myself more than I value my captain? And I truly believe that this was a free will decision for Data, because I don't think there was anything in his programming that would drive him to make the choice that he makes.
Unless it's like, you know, Asimov's law of robotics or something, right? You know, don't allow a human to come to harm kind of thing. But that doesn't seem to apply with Data.
No, it doesn't seem to apply.
But I think you're right. I mean, either way, he just, you know, whichever choice he made, you would say Data's chosen to make a choice. But yes. I think the harder choice is to sacrifice himself at that point. That's the more irrational thing to do. The easy choice would be to beam himself back. Yes, you know, Captain Picard would die, but, you know, that's kind of the easier choice. The self-preservation choice is often the easiest choice, I think, right? Because we're driven to self-preservation in a lot of ways. And, you know, when we're under threat or under whatever, you know, people are often acting on reflex, you know, at that point, self-preservation instincts. And I guess my point is just that Data's choice there to sacrifice himself is a counter self-preservation, freely chosen choice, that as much as we ever see from Data.
Yeah. And I know a lot of Star Trek fans just hate this conversation when you talk about Nemesis and Data dying.
That's what makes it such a brilliant movie, though. That's why I love Nemesis.
Yes, it is. Because we do hate it when people we care about die. We do hate that, and I hated it. I hated watching it, and so I think it's uncomfortable. But I have to appreciate the fact that this was the fitting end to Data's journey to become a more authentic human, rather than just a collection of programming and circuitry and so on and so forth. This was a true irrational leap of faith, a free will choice to put his captain, to put his crew ahead of himself and sacrifice himself.
Well, and I think we all have this kind of Data moment. It's not as dramatic. Sometimes it's literally as dramatic as sacrificing yourself. I mean, certainly, yeah, I mean, people in the military have to do that, right? I've never had to sacrifice myself to save someone else, although I'd like to think I would. But, you know, we all have had to make the transition from being driven by Data's driven by his programming. He's programmed to be a certain way by Dr. Sung. He's got to overcome that. We have to overcome our programming. We have to overcome our backgrounds. We have to overcome our innate temperaments. We have to overcome other people's expectations. We have to overcome the rules sometimes. And then once in a while, we get the opportunity to be the authentic versions of ourselves. And we go, nope, putting on the brakes, all that stuff doesn't matter to me. This thing matters more, so I'm going to do blank. And then you go and do it. And it often is against all the influences that I just mentioned. And I think everyone has to do that to some degree about something in their lives. Otherwise, you just remain an infant forever if you don't do that. This is what it means to grow up. This is what it means to be an adult. It's what it means to be human. It's what it means to be authentic. And Data has gone from an infant being constrained by his programming to, you arguably could say, being a teenager, being constrained by Starfleet's rules and expectations and his development process. At a certain point, he's a fully developed personality with autonomy, and he can decide what matters to me as an individual. And in that moment, he decides, you know, against whatever rules there are, against whatever he should do. I don't even know if it's against something, it's, you know, because maybe the rules say he should, you know, save as many people as possible. I don't know. Maybe that's what the rule actually says. But in that moment, he knows the significance of what he's doing, and he's choosing to do it. And that's as human as he's ever going to get. Data is a fully developed, autonomous, adult, individual human at that point.
Data is adulting.
Data is adulting. But I think sadly, a lot of adults, you know, frankly, act like infants and teenagers. They feel they're artificially constrained and they're not doing things authentically, when really they have the power to be the more authentic version of themselves if they work at it.
Sure. Sure.
So this whole thing is a metaphor for all of human life, I think, to paint it with very broad, grandiose brushstrokes.
Zachary, any final thoughts?
You know, I think my final thoughts, part of them are Star Trek related. I think it's interesting that we were able to find as many examples of these personality types and these approaches to life in Star Trek as we were able to. But stepping outside the Star Trek universe for a minute, I think that most people, including myself, including you, sometimes, a lot of the time, are unreflective about the mode that we're in. You know, we can be aesthetic novelty seekers without realizing that's what we're doing, to the detriment of the things that really matter in life. We can be so rule-based and duty-driven, functioning based on other people's expectations or our company's expectations or our family's expectations, that we're not being the authentic version of ourselves. And once in a while, we get the opportunity either to put the brakes on and say, nope, this is not for me. I'm going to do something radically different and radically more authentic. Or we can choose, like Captain Sisko did, to embrace where you're at and make your station in life the authentic version of yourself. You know, I think Captain Sisko is interesting because he doesn't put the brakes on radically. He doesn't leave Starfleet and do those radical things. He eventually realizes that his destiny is right where he is, and he embraces where he's at. And so I think when you have that moment of crisis of faith, you're faced with a couple of options. We talked about Christian theology a little bit. Inside Christian theology, you can go, I'm going to leave the church and, you know, be an agnostic or be an atheist. You can put the brakes on radically and do something totally different with your life and dedicate your life to something completely different, to where you literally have a crisis of faith.
And it happens to people all the time.
Yeah. Or you can hang in there and hope that it becomes authentic at some point. And a lot of people do that. I think I'm one of those. I've had crises of faith, and at a certain point it becomes more authentic. But I think, you know, it's up to individual people what to do. You know, when you have a crisis of faith about your own life in terms of what matters to you and what you should be doing, you can either put the brakes on and do something totally different, and that's a perfectly viable thing to do, you know, to be a more authentic version of yourself. Or you can hang in there and have that irrational leap of faith about right where you're at, hoping that it becomes meaningful to you, or choosing to embrace. I think Captain Sisko really chooses to become the emissary and chooses to identify as the captain of Deep Space Nine, whereas, you know, his early self doesn't do that. And I think we're all like that. We can put the brakes on, do something different. Sometimes that's the right thing to do for us to be authentic. And sometimes the right thing to do is just decide, you know, I'm going to have a good day today, no matter what comes my way. And I find myself doing this all the time, where it's like, you know, not feeling good in the morning, not, you know, I got to do all these things that I don't really want to do. And at a certain point you go, you know, life is pretty good. I'm going to, you know, got a wife, got a house, got a job, get to do my podcast, you know, life is great. And you just have to go, that's who I am. That's what I'm choosing to do today. And I'm going to find meaning in it. And that's not always easy. And I feel like that's, in a way, the easier thing to do. It's harder to put the brakes on and do something radically different with your life. It's easier to be authentic by saying, you know, this is who I am today, and this is what I have to do. So I might as well have a good day and choose to do it. And think what the world would be like if everyone woke up every day saying, you know, I don't really want to do some of these things. You know, they're hard, they're difficult, I got other things I want to do, but darn it, this is who I am. This is what I got to do. I'm just going to have a good day, and I'm going to do it anyway. And that's who I am today. The world would be amazing if everyone woke up tomorrow and did that.
Yeah, and then sometimes you've just got to get in the Delta Flyer and warp to Ryza and find some pleasure, get some balance. I'm surprised at how many examples that we were able to find, certainly. And I think the examples that we found are really good examples. And again, I'm so glad you mentioned Fajo from Star Trek The Next Generation. I think that was a brilliant connection. I find it fascinating, again, that as we look to Star Trek for examples of people in these different stages of life's way, we come to basically the same conclusions that we come to in here in the real world. And I don't think that's an accident at all. I think that at different times, sometime or another, we can find Commander Riker being very aesthetic and other times being very ethical. And even from time to time, I think falling into that religious stage of life's way where he's a very, very genuine, very sincere, willing to take those irrational leaps of faith.
When he chooses to stay on the Enterprise, I think that's when he has the opportunity to get his own command, but he chooses freely to stay on the Enterprise at a certain point. I think that's maybe his most authentic moment when, you know, he has the opportunity to do what is expected, which is to accept the promotion. And, you know, it's what he thinks he wants, what he's mm-hmm. been telling himself he wants. But it turns out that his innermost sincere self is to stay on the Enterprise. And we do see Riker making that irrational, authentic choice.
Again, there is an example of someone falling into each of those categories. And I think that's true. Just like Star Trek is an exploration of the human condition, I think that's true of all of us. I think that even the best of us have moments of imbalance and we have crisis of faith, but it's really about trying to determine, you know, what is the most authentic version of self. And each of these characters in Star Trek, and some that we don't mention, I hope that our listeners will chime in. I'd like to hear some of our, you know, some of the thoughts of our listeners as they make our different arguments for this character or that character, perhaps falling into some of these. I know we've got a few of our listeners that chime in from time to time. We want to invite you to do that, but I think that it's true in life. You know, we struggle to find that balance and to really discover. I think part of life is that discovery of, you know, what is, you know, the most sincere, genuine version of ourselves. And life's journey is just about that. Just like Wesley came to a point where he had to make a decision. Is he going to follow his father's path or is he going to follow his own? And I think we can relate to that. I think that's very relatable. So, you know, just find the balance and, you know, look inward and discover, you know, what it is inside you that makes you tick and what really makes you feel the most authentic that you can possibly feel and be that. And if you find moments of imbalance, you know, seek some adventure, find some pleasure, or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe for the person that is, you know, so novelty driven, aesthetically driven, you know, maybe it's about, you know, buckling down and you know, taking on some responsibility. And I know I had that moment in my life when I was in my early 20s. You know, I was very aesthetic and you know, I was first coming to faith and I became very rule driven, very, you know, very duty driven, and finding the balance between, you know, that aesthetic nature and that ethical nature.
Well, religious people can do this, right? They can approach their religion by as a series of rules. Do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. And they can apply
that. And that's truly religion. It's not sincere faith, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's an authentic way. And you might still believe some of those ethical principles, but you know, there's a way of doing them inauthentically from a pure duty-based standpoint. Then there's genuine, sincere belief, and that is different from purely following rules. Yeah.
Absolutely. I can think back early, you know, early when I first became a believer, I was very legalistic. You know, I was very driven by rules, and that was good for me at that time, at that point in time, because, you know, my teen years were, I was very aesthetic. I was always looking for the, you know, for the next adventure, the next pleasure, and, you know, very, you know, I was very Faggio.
Well, I do think there is a sense in which these stages can be linear, right? You can, if you are a young rebellious aesthetic seeker as a teenager, you need rules and structure,
Tuvok.
Right? So, Tuvok, you need to become Tuvok who has rules and principles. You need that structure to ground you. And then at a certain point, you realize those aren't enough to find meaning and add value to your life. And you have to decide what you want to dedicate your life to. So there's a sense in which these can be linear, but my experience was not that. My experience was more that these three components are always pulling at me every moment of every day. You know, I can decide, you know, hey, I do like pleasure and I do like new things. I'm like anyone, right? I can be Riker going to Ryzen, no problem. But, you know, that's not always healthy. It's not productive. You need to balance yourself in responsibilities and things you need, you know, need to do to have a healthy life. And then there's finding meaning in all of it. And these are just different pulls for me every day. And I really agree with you. I want to hear from listeners on this. And I say this all the time, you listeners out there, I want to hear from you on this. Which characters in Star Trek live in these different modes, the aesthetic novelty seeking approach, or the ethical rule based approach, or the religious sincere commitment, genuine dedication approach to life. But I also want to hear about your personal stories. My experience is different from Mike's, which is different from all of yours out there. So I love hearing people's stories. I do want to hear not just about Star Trek, because Star Trek is interesting and it's important, but it's not as important as our actual lives. So, you know, where does this come up for you guys? When have you felt like you're being inauthentic? When have you felt like you're constrained by rules? When have you felt like you're really embracing the most authentic version of yourselves? This is a matter of personal meaning and stories. And I want to hear those stories from you listeners out there if you get the opportunity to share them.
Zachary, you know, there have been times when it's been very linear. There have been times that it's, you know, I'm struggling with each of these all at once.
Yeah, so sometimes I struggle with not having enough fun. Sometimes I struggle with doing the right thing. And sometimes I struggle with finding meaning. And I don't think, this has not been a linear experience for me, whereas I think Kierkegaard kind of implies that for a lot of people, this can be linear, but it's not all the time. For you, it sounds like the progression was a bit more linear than it was for me. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's the psychological impulses and drives that drive us to each of these approaches that I feel in the moment all the time and always have throughout my entire life, really, if I look back and analyze it retroactively. But, you know, for some people, I think it's been more linear, where they started out as they were, you know, hell-bent teenagers, and then they became, you know, litigious, what's the term you used?
Legalistic,
you know, rule followers. And then at a certain point, they became authentic. But for me, that's not been I probably started out the exact opposite. I started out more following the rules. I needed to learn to lighten up and have a good time. So...
And of course, next week you'll be struggling with finding meaning and pleasure.
I'll be struggling in finding significant meaning in Las Vegas for sure, where there's no shortage of novelty and pleasures, but there is a shortage of significance and meaning, perhaps.
Viva Las Vegas. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Kierkegaard and the stages of life's way, drawing those connections to the Star Trek universe. But this isn't the only thing that we have been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the 602 Club.
We really devote so little time to our title character. I was really struck by that in this rewatch. I haven't seen this movie since it first came out in theaters. But I was struck by just how little time it feels like Thor's on the screen and how little they delve into his motivation.
Melodic Treks.
I said, this is leisure suit music. This is what somebody thinks is hip music in 1971. You know, when I listened to it again, when you sent me the link to the audio, my thought immediately went to two films, which it turns out he scored, Our Man Flint and In Like Flint.
Literary Treks.
I'm glad we reread this, because at the time I did read this, it was when the new movie was out. But now that we've had the three movies, as you just mentioned, and I've seen Star Trek 09 about 100 times, I'm very familiar with the movie and not as much as with the comic now, because I've only read it maybe a couple of times.
To the journey!
I've just got this vision now of Janeway there. Who's a good Voyager? Who's a good girl?
Well, she liked to, you know, stroke the halls and everything.
So Tom Paris would be like, who's a good girl? You want to go for a ride? Let's go.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no problem. We got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. And now, Zachary, you can also find us on YouTube as well as Google Play Music. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, you can get a producer credit right here on Metatrex if you like, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And please don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of Metatrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our Metatrex show page on the Trek FM website, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're on Facebook, find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Just hit the join button, and someone will let you right in. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
Zachary, we'd also like to invite our listeners to leave us a rating and a review of Metatrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. So, Zachary, when you're not planning your warp to Las Vegas, where can our listeners find you around the Trek FM network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can hear me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's dedicated Voyager podcast, along with my two co-hosts there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not inauthentically collecting the most toys, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'd love to talk Star Trek and philosophy with you on the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. If you'd like to check out my blog talking about my journey to publish a novel and a little bit about life, you can find that at cmichael1701.wordpress.com. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank our most authentic C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. I'd also like to give a special shout out and a big thank you to Patrick Devlin, one of our associate producers. You can find him on Twitter @MagicDrop5. Our associate producer, Kay Shaw, also your co-host over on To The Journey. Her Twitter handle is @ChocoWeeble. And our newest associate producer, Kit Lofstadt. Her Twitter handle is @MotherCat. That's mother with a zero. Yeah. We want to thank you for helping us keep dilithium in the engines of the Starship of Theseus.
All of our associate producers help us keep the lights on authentically.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to Metatrex's Star Trek and Philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before, authentically.